The people of Colorado are entitled to be frustrated and angry with these public officials and other persons who have brought this case to its current status. We must be mindful, however, of the first cause of the investigation's failure, the refusal of John and Patsy Ramsey to cooperate fully and genuinely with those officially charged with the responsibility of investigating the death of their daughter, JonBenet. Fleet White Jr. and Priscilla Brown White, August 17th, 1998.
Creep It Real is a weekly podcast where we present our theories of the subjects we cover based on our interest and research. Some material may be graphic and disturbing, so proceed with caution.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us again. We are super jazzed by everybody's responses to us so far. It's been really cool to hear how everybody feels about the first episode, and even though we're just still kind of getting used to the swing of things, we've gotten some like really awesome responses so far.
We really appreciate all those listening in. If you could leave us a rating and make sure to tell all your friends about us, that would be much appreciated on our end.
Big time. So iTunes has a kind of specific way that they do things where the more ratings that you have, the more people you're exposed to. So that's why we just ask that you go give us 5 stars so that we can get exposed to more people and more people can hear this stuff.
Yep.
Last episode, we ended talking about the autopsy of JonBenet and how her family had called 911 because she had gone missing. They woke up and said she had gone missing, and come to find out a couple hours later, she was actually dead in their house the whole time. And in the autopsy, it was found that she had experienced a blow to the head that was pretty severe, caused her to be knocked unconscious, and then she was dragged down to the basement where she was sexually assaulted and then strangled to death. And then, let's see.
We have already a bunch of weird things going on with the family, a lot of strange behavior, mismatched stories, and things that don't really coincide with each other. So we're going to delve more into the family police dynamic and some more evidence.
So last time I mentioned that the Ramseys did not give a police interview for weeks, and I misspoke a little bit on that because they actually didn't give an interview for 4 months. So it was almost 4 months to the day that they finally gave an interview to the police after multiple failed attempts. And on they tried about 3 or 4 times, and on the second attempt, their lawyers gave conditions in which they stated that they would only be interviewed if they were interviewed together. Patsy and John were interviewed together only at the attorney's office, and that the interview could last no longer than 1 hour. So that's absurd. The police department was felt a little stuck, I guess you would say, because they have been trying to get an interview for months from these people, and here was an opportunity, but yet the conditions were just ridiculous. And the FBI's Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit, they advised the police department that that was just not acceptable. And so the police department declined that second interview. And then immediately following that, the Ramseys gave a press release that said the officers declined their interview, and that was all the information they gave. So that was just an early example of how they were trying to kind of spin the story in their favor, even though they were really the ones that were just not cooperating.
To me, the only reason why someone would want to be interviewed together is to ensure that their stories matched up and that there was no misinformation from either party,
exactly.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that so that they can't say something that the other person contradicts, because at least if you're in the same room, you don't have that opportunity to just completely not hear them, what they're saying. So April 30th, 4 months later, they finally got an interview, the police, and the aspect about this little interview, that the reason they agreed was because their lawyers demanded that they be given all of the police investigative documents days before their interview. And the DA, Alex Hunter, agreed and gave them all the documents 2 days before their interview. So Patsy and John had access to all the evidence and police reports and anything that you could ever get any information from, and so did their lawyers, before they were interviewed. And, you know, and that is insane, in my opinion, to be blunt. So needless to say, the Boulder Police Department and the DA's relationship was pretty rocky, but I want to say something about the DA giving them the police reports, which is that there was an article released in Vanity Fair where a former FBI agent stated that the release of those documents to the Ramseys was tantamount to prosecutorial malfeasance, which prosecutorial malfeasance is an illegal act or failing to act on the part of a prosecutor, especially an attempt to sway the jury to wrongly convict a defendant or to impose a harsher than appropriate punishment. Shai, I'm going to let you talk, I swear, in a second, but this FBI agent was a 25-year veteran. His name was Greg McCrary, and that's the one who gave this statement to the Vanity Fair writer. And in addition to that, the Ramseys offered, their attorneys offered this guy a place on their investigative team, and he declined. And here's his direct quote. I'm going to just read it to you. "Because at a ratio of 12 to 1, child murders are committed by parents or family member. In this case, you also have an elaborate staging in the ransom note, the placing of the child's body. And I have never in my career heard about staging that wasn't a family member or someone very close to the family. Just the note alone told me the killer was someone in the family or close to it. Kidnappers do not spend hours at the crime scene after murdering their victim to compose letters." So
the Ramseys being able to view all this evidence and police reports and documents puts them at such a huge advantage versus someone that wouldn't be able to devise a game plan knowing what they're going up against when it comes to these interviews. Right.
They had a team of lawyers. Like, they had, it has been called like a cadre. I'm going to call it a swarm at some point in this podcast. Like, they had a team of lawyers working, probably going through those documents, giving them a game plan for how to answer questions that they knew were going to be directed at them. So can you imagine anybody who was guilty of a crime having access to the documents before being questioned by police 4 months later? You know, we've already passed the critical time in a murder investigation, which is in the immediately following the murder. That's the time when you really get the information from people before they're able to get stories lined up together, before they're able to come up with other alternative, you know, excuses we've already passed that critical time. We're 4 months later and they still are getting access to all these documents. That's just insane. This was the only case that the FBI has seen in their history where a child was taken for ransom then murdered in their own home. So the FBI agents were of the opinion that Patsy wrote the ransom note after the death to cover up the murder, and then the additional evidence of a staged crime scene led them to discount the intruder theory altogether. So the FBI also did not believe that there was an intruder. They thought the parents covered up the murder, and that is in line with what the Boulder Police Department also felt. But the only one that didn't feel that way was the district attorney's office.
Exactly. And I just wanted to touch on something because it's kind of interesting that I had read into and found out that a lot of times people don't realize that there is a difference between a staged murder and a posed murder victim. Oftentimes, a staged murder victim is the victim of someone that they knew, you know, especially family. It's more of a cover-up, whereas like a posed murder is a stranger and a killer that's looking for recognition for their product, basically. Right. So this murder was absolutely staged.
All the experts say staging happens by someone that knew them or that it was family.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of evidence that just piles up against this family that it seems to just go completely ignored by everyone in the DA's office. So the DA just continued to be adamant that the Ramseys had nothing to do with the murder. And the Boulder authorities maintained that the community was under no threat of a child murderer. So the Boulder Police Department was telling the public, you don't have anything to be worried about. So then who did they think killed JonBenet? I think we kind of know already, but let's just continue. So the day following the Ramseys' police interviews, which, by the way, Patsy, I believe, was in her interview for 9 hours. John was interviewed for 1 hour. The Ramsey scheduled a private press conference the following day, and it was a very private press event. The only press that was allowed in the room were people who were invited, and they had to have a special password to get in the room. There was all these little hoops they had to jump through in order to attend, even if they were invited. And multiple reporters who attended this press conference said that there was nothing of substance discussed. It was a fluff interview to show that the Ramseys were cooperating with the police, and it was just a way for them to manage and spin their story. And despite their claims to be so cooperative with police, the Ramseys would not interview with the police again for 14 months.
So to me, that just, like you said, it was just like a fluff interview to show, like, hey, look, we're cooperating. Yet it was so set up specifically to their needs and tailored to, like, what would help them. You know right. what I mean? If you were innocent, why wouldn't, I mean, you would offer up any and all information that you possibly could.
Yeah, you would think so. And you would, like, giving the public information is only going to help you possibly find the person that murdered your daughter. But if you don't really want to know who murdered your daughter, or you don't want the public to know who murdered your daughter, then maybe you decide not to share information with them. The Ramsey's attorney said that Burke was only to be interviewed by a psychologist, and he had to be interviewed for the Department of Social Services due to his sister being murdered. It's a routine thing. There was Dr. Suzanne Bernard was the doctor who interviewed him, and she was the only adult in the room. She didn't have planned out questions, and there were no police questions that she was given. She later expressed concern about Burke's affect during the interview, that he showed little emotion or connection with his family. He seemed reticent to talk about his family and showed no attachment to his sister or his parents. She asked him at one point if he felt safe, and without hesitation, he told her yes, that he was not worried about any intruder, even though only days before he had been in a room that was nearly 50 feet away from his sister, who had been snatched supposedly straight out of that bed and murdered brutally in the home that he was sharing with her.
And it's really interesting that you bring that up about him feeling safe, because in an interview with a child psychologist, she asked, you know, were you asleep? Were you awake? And he states that he was awake. And she asked, like, why didn't you go see what was going on? And he said that he was afraid that there was a bad man downstairs and that his dad could have been down there fighting him off and chasing him off with a gun. So right there, are you afraid or are you not? You know what I mean?
Yes. And so I forgot to mention that this interview took place only about a week after JonBenet's death. So it was very close to the time that she died. It was on January 8th.
These interviews that Burke had with these psychologists, they do show a lot. And having watched a few other documentaries and reading into child behavior, a lot of people will argue that violence and the lack of empathy and sympathy is a learned behavior. But there are rare cases where children actually have brain disorders where there's, like, low activity in the frontal lobe that causes them to act out violently, to have major jealousy issues, to lack the empathy, to not have, like, emotions towards pain and other humans. And it seems like Burke is expressing a lot of these. Like, I know you had mentioned something about him keeping secrets.
Yeah, he actually, in the interview, he says he has a secret, but he couldn't tell her what it was or that it wouldn't be a secret anymore.
And I don't know if it's just a creepy coincidence or not, but one of the children in the documentaries I was watching had stated to his mother that he had a secret and he couldn't tell her, or else it wouldn't be a secret anymore. I don't know if it's just weird or somehow connected.
I think it could be. Yeah, it's kind of creepy, definitely. Okay, so at one point, Dr. Bernard asked him about sexual contact, and his demeanor immediately changed. He started to show anxiety. He picked up a board game that they were playing and began to rub it on his head. It showed a contrast from the baseline behavior that he'd established throughout the rest of the interview. So definitely showing some signs of anxiety when asked about sexual contact. And another time when he started to act a little bit strange was when he was asked about his sister's death. He again picked up the board game, rubbed it on his head, and he also held it in front of his face.
In human behavior, a lot of times we're told that we wear masks, and I think even using an inanimate physical object to hide your face is a huge sign of trying to hide something, especially if you're trying to hide emotions or certain reactions with your facial expressions. So this is not normal behavior.
He acted one way throughout the entire interview, and then on two separate occasions, his demeanor completely changed. So, and those were about sexual contact and about his sister's death. So, interesting. She also asked him to draw a family portrait, and in the portrait, he drew Patsy as being smaller than him. He drew his father up in a cockpit in a plane in the sky, and he did not draw JonBenet in the drawing at all. This was, like I said, this was January 8th. JonBenet had been murdered December 26th, and the doctor stated that in her experience, children who had suffered the same kind of loss continued to draw their dead family members in the family portraits for years after the event. And this was only a week later, and he had already just said, well, he was moving on. So as we know, there was a bowl of pineapple and cream on the kitchen counter in the home the morning that JonBenet died. And that was noted by many people that knew the family and by the family themselves that Burke's favorite treat was a bowl of pineapple and cream. In the interview, there was an actual crime scene photo of that pineapple and milk that was sitting on the counter in their kitchen. And he was asked what that was. And he was like, I don't know, maybe it's cereal. He just like could not identify what it was in this picture when it's clearly not cereal. It's clearly pineapples in milk, and it was his favorite treat. And yet for some reason, he was just like, I don't know, I have no idea. And I have to think that it has something to do with the fact that Patsy was so adamant that she didn't get that for them and that Burke had no part in the pineapple. It's like someone told him, you don't know, you know, you had no idea what that pineapple and cream was. You had nothing to do with it. And so he just was like, all of a sudden after this, after the murder of his sister, he suddenly went from pineapple and cream being his favorite treat to he couldn't identify pineapple and cream if you paid him to. Just interesting.
Well, because we can't forget that Patsy was so adamant about that not being something that she gave them that night, but there was partly digested pineapple in JonBenet's stomach
upon the
medical.
Yeah, so it could tie them together, tie the two kids together at a time close to her death. The last little bit of information from that interview that we found to be just slightly noteworthy was that they were playing Guess Who, and Burke accidentally flipped down the wrong person, and he said, oops, you're not dead yet, which I just found to be kind of callous at that time. Like, it's a week after his sister was murdered brutally. And maybe his mind was just in that zone. I don't know. It just seems weird to me.
It is a bit morbid for such a young boy to, because I remember playing that game and not once did it cross my mind that these people were dying when you had to flip them down.
They were just, you were just knocking them down. You weren't killing them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The whole family has such interesting choice of words when they are being interviewed. In one of the interviews, Patsy stated that, no, you know, I didn't slaughter my baby, which to me is like so unnecessary and a bit abrasive.
Yeah.
When you just could simply have said, I didn't kill my daughter.
Yeah, it's a little... So. Yeah, it's a little extreme, I would say.
Morbid family.
Yeah. Dr. Bernard also advised that bedwetting typically ends between the ages of 3 and 4, and if it's carried into the 5th year, it is usually indicative of medical or emotional issues. And we know both Burke and JonBenet had bedwetting issues that went beyond the age of 5. Burke was 9, and he was pooping all over the place.
And not just, like, pooping his pants, but, like, pooping in, you know, boxes of chocolate and...
Yeah.
JonBenet's bed.
Right, in a way that was almost seemed like it was targeting her as some sort of punishment or something. You know, like, I'm going to poop in your box of chocolates. I'm going to poop in your bed.
Well, it's kind of symbolic because here we have JonBenet, this beautiful beauty queen, this picture of perfection, and it's almost like Burke's finding these ways to tarnish that beauty and to not make it perfect anymore.
Right, that's a good point. Actually, we're not done. Here's the last actual bit. So when Burke was asked what he thought happened to his sister, he said, I know what happened. Someone quietly carried her downstairs to the basement and then either stabbed or struck a blow to her head with a hammer. And he actually acted it out twice in the exact overhand blow that was responsible for the injury that JonBenet sustained. So that's just a coincidence. And in addition to that, he never mentioned strangulation like he had to his friend Anthony only a week earlier. I talked about last episode that a mother of one of his friends had heard Burke and her son speaking about whether JonBenet had been strangled manually. And this lady was Mary Ann Kempfer. And whenever the family went to Atlanta for JonBenet's funeral, Mary Ann and her son attended as well. And she watched Burke and her son because she didn't know anybody else there. So her son Anthony had said that Burke at the time, he kind of knew what happened and trusted that people would find out. And I found that to be interesting, that that was his opinion of Burke about his sister's death. He said Burke was fine and he never saw him cry. And again, Burke and Anthony discussed whether or not JonBenet had been manually strangled, and it was only 2 days after she had died. So there were no reports being released about that at the time. So and again, there were no reports being released about the head injury either at the time of his interview with the psychologist. So he knew these in details about her death that I'm not really sure how he was able to know these things. But also, why, I wonder, did he not bring up strangulation with the doctor like he had with his friend? Was he like trying to mislead her?
I think he was hiding it from her, and he felt like maybe he could trust his little friend. Like, you know, mentioned, it was just a matter of not giving details to people that could get him in trouble.
Yeah.
Also, too, you know, I'm sure everybody's seen it, but there's this famous interview with him and Dr. Phil, and Burke's a 29, almost 30-year-old man, but I feel like he never grew up. Like, there's something there. His demeanor and the way he carries himself is not a man at all. He's still very much that little boy. And it's kind of very strange to watch. I don't know if this whole thing kind of robbed him of his childhood, but he's smiling the whole time. And it's a very uncomfortable smile, but he's smiling and kind of sheepish grinning.
It's really weird. Yeah, it is. It's just kind of off-putting. I knew that that interview had taken place last year, but for some reason, until Shai said that, I did not think about the fact that he was 30 years old and not, I was just looking at him like he was like a 17-year-old kid. It was just, it's very weird to think that he's 30 years old there.
In the interview, even, you know, he was asked about what he thought when he saw his sister at the funeral, and he was kind of saying how he just noticed the little casket and that one side of her face was droopy. And he kind of just brushed it off as like an ordinary everyday thing that you would experience. You know, oh, her eye was kind of droopy. Her casket was small. Not, you know, oh, I was deeply saddened and felt lost without my little sister. It was just, if you watch the interview, it'll creep you out.
It's a little creepy. So while Burke was being interviewed by Dr. Bernard, Patsy was sitting out in the waiting room with Detective Arndt, the detective that had been to the house on the day of JonBenet's murder. And Patsy said to her, "I would have nothing to live for if I lost Burke." If that doesn't give her motive right there to cover up perhaps some actions that he took in taking her daughter's life, I don't know what does. That to me is like, yet again, another kind of spontaneous utterance that I kind of can't believe she even said that to a police officer. So the police had been trying to get a search warrant to the Ramsey home for a while, and they ended up not getting one, but the DA was able to obtain one, to which the police were able to accompany them. The Ramseys had moved out of the house, and most of their belongings were gone. When they arrived, detectives found there were a bunch of motion sensor cameras around the house with wires that were leading down to a closet beneath a basement stairwell. The door was locked, and so one of the officers kicked the door down, and inside the closet there was a recorder that was leading from all of those motion sensor cameras that actually had actual cameras on them. There was the wires leading down to this closet, and they were all being recorded onto a VHS tape. So later it was found, they took the tape, and it was later found that the police were all recorded whenever they would be in various rooms where these cameras were. The police took the tape, they broke the door down, and they didn't fix it, and yet the Ramseys, the attorneys, the realtor, none of them spoke a word of that to the detectives or the DA or anybody after that. So why was that closet? Why was there a camera taping their movements in the closet? And why did they feel like they couldn't bring it up to them for like compensation for money to fix the door or something afterwards? The other aspect of that was that the camera had to be manually turned on to record. So it wasn't just recording all the time. So somebody had to have gone over there before the police and the DA was scheduled to arrive at the home to turn that camera on to begin recording them.
I don't know about y'all, but that little bit of information just gives me the heebie-jeebies. I can't imagine discovering that your moves are being recorded and you don't know where or why this device was installed. It's so creepy.
Yeah, heebie-jeebies is like the right word to use there, because that is creepy as heck. That's about as creepy that probably might be more creepy than Patsy peering through her fingers at the police. So the detectives, they spent a good week at this house conducting all sorts of experiments to try and replicate the scene, the night of the murder and the morning of the murder. They found the home extremely difficult to move around in darkness. The spiral staircase that the ransom note was found at the bottom of was like a death trap, they said. They said that trying to go down those stairs while holding a child would be extremely dangerous in the dark and not feasible, really. We're talking about multiple people were supposed to be going through this house in the dark. You know, it's just without anyone else hearing, it just is not likely. There was an electric cord that was tied to some Christmas lights in a basement window. So it left the basement window a little bit ajar. And they determined that that is how the neighbor Melody Stanton heard the scream at 1 a.m., obviously, that lady recanted her story, but why would you recant hearing a scream at 1 a.m. in the middle of the night? That just doesn't make any sense. They also had an expert to conduct the lighting experiments exactly as it was the day that John was supposedly discovered JonBenet's body in the wine cellar the moment that he opened the door. I mean, they put the blanket in there. They had all the lighting exactly as it was that day. And they determined that you had to actually walk into the room and like round the corner before you would ever be able to see anything in that room. It was impossible that he opened that door as Fleet White, his friend, had said, and immediately shouted that she was in there. He had to have known that already. And it also, he also told about two other people that he had discovered her earlier in the day also. So he obviously knew her body was there before he ever said anything to police. And that's sketchy, I would say.
Well, also too, the DA, they found the window that supposedly that these kidnappers came through and tried to show himself how easy it would be to climb down in there and through the window. But it made no sense because the spider webs and dust on the grate and around the area were not disturbed at all. Mm-hmm. Also, too, I think Ashley brought up that the DA was a smaller man. So, I mean, of course, easily he would have fit in through this window area, but a fleet of kidnappers, I don't think so.
No way. I mean, I'm so frustrated, I just can barely speak. We'll move on past that, but that there are some experiments that were conducted to try to either prove or disprove the Ramsey's accounts of the events of that day, and they are coming up showing that they're not accurate in their accounts.
Yeah, nothing is working out for them. Their experiments are kind of disproving these theories of a kidnapper or kidnappers. Right.
And, you know, in addition, so we have actual experiments proving this, in addition to the FBI stating this, in addition to the Boulder Police Department from all their other information saying this, yet the DA is adamant it's an intruder. So the Boulder Police ended up getting their own prosecutors because they just did not feel like they were working on the same team as the district attorney's office. And the media really harped on these strained relations between the Boulder police and the district attorney. At one point, because of the media harping on this, the district attorney, Aaron Hunter, and the chief of Boulder police, Mark Beckner, agreed to share a space together to investigate the JonBenet Ramsey murder together in a shared space. So the Boulder police were gone for a few days, and when they came back, they realized that somebody had tried to gain access to their computer and obtain private documents that were on that computer. They had a couple different IT guys come out, and everybody stated the same thing, that somebody tried to gain access to their private documents. So that was when the Boulder police ended their relationship with the DA on that investigation, and it lasted a whopping 1.5 months together in that room trying to find the killer of JonBenet. They were essentially diametrically opposed on their theories of the events. So the DA was just so stuck on this intruder theory, the police were like, no, dude. There was no intruder. There's something going on here with the family, and nobody wanted to hear it.
So the Boulder Police Department is beyond frustrated at this point. I mean, they're presenting the DA with this evidence, and the DA is just kind of dismissing it and not making a big deal out of things that could possibly help solve the case. So, yeah, like you said, at that point, they were just done with each other.
I mean, can you even imagine how frustrating that has to be to put all that time and manpower into investigating, have all this evidence, and yet you're just being told, nope, just doesn't make sense, even though it does. I mean, good grief.
Yeah.
So the Boulder police had been seriously deliberating, pushing for a grand jury inquiry for a while. And in June of 1998, Boulder investigators and forensic experts outlined evidence to the Colorado Attorney General's Office, the FBI Child Abduction Serial Killer Unit, Boulder police prosecutors, and the DA and his staff. They presented all of this evidence that was stating that they wanted to indict the Ramseys. The DA dragged their feet and dragged their feet, and they interviewed the Ramseys without the Boulder police. And then finally, after a lead investigator on the case resigned, citing frustration and mishandling by the district attorney in a public document, the DA finally agreed to a grand jury inquest. Only one representative from the Boulder police was allowed to attend, so the majority of the detectives that were familiar with the case were not permitted to testify or have access to any of the documents and records acquired by the subpoena. That was extremely frustrating. I can only imagine, because the Boulder police were saying, the Ramseys had not been charged with the crime, but their swarm of attorneys was making demands exclusively reserved for the rights of criminal defendants. I can imagine that's pretty freaking frustrating. The grand jury was a jury of 12 people. They studied evidence and information that is not all available to the public for 1 year. And after 1 year of deliberating and seeing things and documents and all sorts of things that we're not privy to, the grand jury came down with a recommendation of indictment of both John and Patsy Ramsey, which concluded, and I want to read this out and I want you all to really pay attention. They concluded that John and Patsy each unlawfully, knowingly, recklessly, and feloniously permitted a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation which posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, resulting in her death. They also found that John and Patsy did render assistance to a person with intent to hinder, delay, and prevent discovery, detection, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and punishment of such person for the commission of a crime, knowing the person being assisted has committed and was suspected of the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. So in other words, the jurors seem to say that John and Patsy didn't kill their daughter, but they opened up the situation for her to be killed, and then they helped the person that killed her cover up the crime, okay? Like, oh my goodness. Has anyone ever even heard that before? Please let us know, because I had never heard that before in all the time I'd heard about JonBenet Ramsey and all the details I knew. I never knew that.
Why this case is so frustrating, because of the media just kind of like portrayed it as, you know, the parents did it, but there's like no really motive for the parents to kill her. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's important for us to, you know, look into these facts and actually get what's right and what's true.
Even though the grand jury came back with recommendations of indictments, the DA, Alex Hunter at the time, decided not to indict the Ramseys per the grand jury ruling, obviously left the investigators extremely frustrated. And I want to mention here that in the state of Colorado, Colorado law prohibits anyone under the age of 10 from being implicated or even mentioned in relation to any crime. I feel like that in itself gives you all the answers that you need to know about who did this and why the grand jury came to that conclusion. In addition to that, because I'm talking about Burke here, he was 9 years old. Okay, he was a couple weeks away from being 10, but at the time he was 9. And in the first episode, we discussed how there was that 911 call where at the end of the tape, his voice is on there. And that family was so adamant that he was asleep in his bed the whole time. Like, they stated that over and over and over. So the tape that was sent to the aerospace engineers that enhanced the audio for the police and the district attorney's office, they actually leaked it to the media at one point, or somebody that worked for them did. And it was aired on Geraldo Rivera one time. Okay. So the very first airing of that show, it aired that tape. There are people who were alive and watching that show that remember it, that it aired. But in the subsequent airing later that day, it was removed from the broadcast. And there was a note, a legal document stating that they could not show it ever again for legal reasons, because a judge prohibited the release, which in my opinion supports our our theory, that Burke was on that tape because he was 9 years old at the time. This was in relation to a crime. And as the law states that someone under the age of 10 can't even be implicated or mentioned in relation to a crime. So there really is no other reason why that audio of the enhanced 911 call would be prohibited from being aired again, unless it was because there was a child that was involved in this situation. So
yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because I feel like unless you don't know the in and outs of law, that the parents of any child would not, I mean, unless you know you had experience with it, you wouldn't know these types of laws and just how much of the, you know, to the extent they go to protect these children. So
right. So Fleet and Priscilla White, the Ramsey's friends, the very good friends who we've spoken about multiple times in this podcast so far, they went to their house on Christmas Day. They were called, the first people they called after Patsy hung up the 911 call. They came to their house the day that JonBenet was supposedly kidnapped immediately. This couple wrote a letter to the media immediately following the murder of JonBenet because they wanted a special prosecutor to get involved on the case. And a year later, in August of 98, they wrote the governor at the time, Roy Romer, because they wanted him to intervene and appoint a special prosecutor because they thought the DA mishandled the case. And when they closed their letter to the governor, they cited the Ramsey's refusal to cooperate as the first cause for reason of failure of the case. So this is their best friends that we're talking about here.
So imagine your best friends trying to pretty much throw you under the bus and get a more thorough investigation of you. This is huge. I feel like this was overlooked almost.
So I read one of their letters at the beginning of this podcast, but you can go look at these letters online. They're public documents now and see exactly what they say. But they cite that the Ramsey's attorneys have close relationships with many of the top Boulder officials and that, you know, the police are not mishandling the case as the media and the Ramsey's are trying to make them out to be doing. They're saying that this is purposeful mishandling by the DA's office due to their relationships. And from everything that we've read, I can't say I disagree, honestly.
No.
Here's an example of this. So Lou Smith was the lead investigator for the DA since the beginning, up until this point in about 98. So he's the one that was just pushing this intruder theory like crazy. He went and did experiments through, we talked about it just a minute ago, where he said you could slip through the basement window really easily, blah, blah, blah. When he resigned from the DA's office as the investigator on this case and went on to work with the Ramseys and their investigative team to find the quote unquote intruder. He had stated multiple times that he looked into John and Patsy's eyes and knew they were innocent from that alone. He also told a later investigator that it took 1 week for him to come up with the intruder conclusion based off of photographs of the scene. No mention of police documents or investigative documents. It was the photographs of the scene. 1 week. And it took the same investigator months to come up with his theory that was much more involved than that. So that was just one example of the DA's relationship with the Ramseys, the DA's office relationship with the Ramseys. That's inappropriate.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be finding justice, you know, like that's their job, is to get justice for this 6-year-old girl that's been murdered.
Definitely a shady sort of relationship. They're almost too close together. And he retired as a DA, but went to go work directly for the Ramseys, like you said. It's just a little suspicious to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's not even where it ends. So we'll get into more of it later. But I mean, the DA is just, they're just up the Ramsey's butts, if you don't mind me saying so. So the lead prosecutor on the grand jury inquest, his name was Michael Caine, and he spent many hours interviewing the Ramseys, more than probably the police even got to, and had access to all those documents, like I said, that we don't have access to because we're not in the grand jury. And he said he felt that they had yet to give him a straight story. And he felt like their responses were like a press secretary giving spin, and they were careful and often scripted, and it was extremely concerning to him.
In October of 2000, the Ramsey's attorney, Lynn Wood, drafted a document for the district attorney, Hunter, basically clearing Burke of any suspicion. He then stated that the only way that he would sign it is if that paragraph was removed from the letter. And the paragraph said, from 12/26/96 to present, Burke Ramsey has not been and is not at present a suspect in the murder of his sister, JonBenet Ramsey.
So I have heard so many people use this document signed by the district attorney clearing Burke of guilt as the reason why Burke didn't commit this murder. But Burke's attorney wrote the letter and sent it to the district attorney without any request on his part. So, you know, that, first of all, that doesn't really say a lot to me in the first place. And then to say that this a district attorney wouldn't sign it unless the sentence that Burke Ramsey has not been and is not at present a suspect in the murder of his sister, JonBenet Ramsey, that seems odd too. So that document was really a piece of fluff that the Ramsey's attorneys sent over to the district attorney's office to kind of coerce them into signing to make it look to the public like they were innocent of any guilt. And that's bullcrap. It's bullcrap. So don't come at me using that as a reason why Burke is not guilty. Oh no.
The letter has like enraged a lot of people too, basically stating that like, he had no right to do that. It wasn't like in his, he wasn't like cleared to do such a thing.
No. In 2002, Boulder Police Department Chief Mark Beckner handed the JonBenet Ramsey case over to the DA's office. He said he had exhausted his leads and he felt that he was now building a case for the defense because they just weren't working with him. The media painted it as that the district attorney had taken the case away from the police, but they don't have the authority to do so. And so that's not true. They gave it over because they were like, I'm trying to work with somebody who refuses to listen to anything that I have to say. Any of the facts that I have, they're not listening. I am not going to waste my manpower and resources on this case any longer.
Yep.
So yeah, but just another way the media has painted this case to be something that it isn't. Alex Hunter at some point resigns, and a new DA, Mary Lacey, is on the JonBenet Ramsey case.
She's almost worse, to be honest.
Oh, yes. She might be less objective than even Alex Hunter, somehow.
Just looking at her behavior from the very beginning, it's very suspicious.
It's very suspicious. So, yeah, she invited the Ramseys in just to talk with them upon getting her job, and she wanted to give them all of the DA's investigative files, all of them. Tom Bennett, who was her lead investigator for the DA at the time, refused to allow that to happen. And luckily, he prevailed in not giving them the files. But it was just an unprecedented request. It's just ridiculous. So Tom Bennett, in June of 2005, decided to retire. He was just spending so much time working on this case for the DA's office. And he handed the case over to James Kohler, who had been working beneath him on the case. And James Kohler became the lead investigator for the district attorney on the JonBenet Ramsey case from 2005 to 2006. And he's also the author of the book Foreign Faction, Who Really Kidnapped JonBenet. And that is where Shai and I got a lot of our information for this podcast. And he was given 9 years of collected evidence, documents, and was given access to the grand jury material as well. So he had all the evidence in the JonBenet case that, you know, even the stuff that we can't see at this point. He's pretty key to how we came to our conclusions.
His book was really insightful without being accusatory, I guess you could say. It was just a lot of facts and evidence that I think a lot of people weren't aware of. Even, you know, there was a lot of stuff that we didn't know until we actually read the book. So it was very well done, and it's kind of interesting what happened, you know, after this case was said and done, what route he took.
Yeah, and he wrote this book after he stopped working on this case. And, I mean, he has no ulterior motive here. He's not making money off of this book. I believe he made enough money to pay for the work it took to produce it, and then he donated the rest. Like, he had no motive to write this book and draw these conclusions other than that he wanted the public to know the information that we were not being told.
Well, and I mean, I feel like the book's not like what I would call sexy facts. Like,
oh right, yeah, yeah.
It's not the media circus that people love to soak up and soak in. It's just all the facts that we need to know. So
right,
that's why I think we appreciated it so much.
Yeah, it was a great book. It was we read a few books in researching, but that was the one that was the best with information for me. So some of the evidence that he found was that it took the Ramseys 1 year to give the detectives clothing from their Christmas clothes that they needed for elimination purposes. Patsy's jacket that was found to match the fibers that were found on the sticky side of the duct tape that was found on JonBenet's mouth was actually a brand new jacket that had the fold lines on it still, and it had never been worn. So it took her a year to give him not even the jacket she was actually wearing, but a jacket that they went out and bought that was the same jacket, which, what the hell? So the lab identified 8 different fibers on the sticky side of the duct tape that were microscopically and chemically consistent to each other and Patsy's jacket. And the same fibers were also found in the wrist and the neck ligatures that were found on JonBenet. They conducted a ton of experiments trying to lift fibers with the duct tape to replicate, you know, if it was in fact because Patsy lived in the home, like they were just incidentally picked up. But when they tried to just kind of like pick up fibers from the ground, it only resulted in a couple of fibers being picked up. There were a lot of fibers, 8 different fibers that were on that duct tape, and it was they believe that it was direct contact that was responsible for the fibers on the duct tape and on the ligatures. So Patsy claimed to have never been down in the basement that morning, and yet her jacket had somehow come in contact with the duct tape and the ligatures. So there's something that doesn't really line up there.
Well, and, you know, people could argue while she lived there, the fibers could come in contact with anything in the house. True, but a roll of duct tape is a roll of duct tape. The sticky side is not exposed until someone physically and manually unrolls it,
yeah.
Which would mean it's close to your hands, which would mean it's close to your cuffs on if you were wearing a jacket.
Right, and you know, from their experiments, they didn't pick up that many fibers as much as there were on the inside of the duct tape. So there's really no explanation other than that Patsy somehow did something with the duct tape and the ligatures, you know? So the family withheld Burke and JonBenet's medical records from the detectives, stating that they deserved an island of privacy regarding JonBenet's murder. I believe that these medical records have all the answers that we would ever need to know about this case. I believe it would be pretty open and shut if the detectives were able to have access and the grand jury was able to have access to the medical records of Burke. I believe that would tell you everything you need to know.
Again, we have to remember that Patsy was all about appearances, keeping up with the Joneses, if not being bigger and better than them. And having one of your children suffer from some sort of mental disorder, exhibiting violent, especially sexually violent behaviors towards another family member would be such an embarrassment, we feel, to her and her family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons why we feel like maybe she wouldn't release these. But then again, it could just be being a protective parent.
It's possible. So. Yeah, sure. And another thing that really stood out to him was that Patsy stated straight up that she didn't read that note, the ransom note, before she called 911. Yet somehow, like I mentioned in the first episode, she knew that it ended with SBTC victory, even though at the moment that she was on that call, she was in a different room than John. He had his back to her and he was reading a note, the note on the ground. He wasn't like holding it up over his head so that she could also see it.
Right.
And somehow she knew that. So these were just some of the big red flags that he, and there were more, but this was some of the big red flags that stood out to him whenever he went through the evidence. In 2000, James Kohler made a presentation to the DA, Mary Lacey, stating that he felt the investigation into the Ramsey family should be reopened. He said that they never focused on Burke before, but there was ample evidence that they should. And I am going to tell you exactly what she said to him. And he says it in his book, word for word. She stated, "I don't want my relationship with the Ramseys to be affected by this. I have to think about it." And then she eventually told him no. But the DA, okay, is sitting there telling the lead investigator for the murder of JonBenet Ramsey that she does not want her relationship with the Ramsey family to be affected in the pursuit of justice for the murder of the 6-year-old girl. So I would have to say that you're failing at doing your job altogether. Like, what the hell is that?
Well, we have to remember exactly how rich the Ramseys were, and yeah, like you said, isn't the job of a district attorney to bring justice? Like, that's...
You would hope.
Yeah, you would hope. But not in this case, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, time and time again, the DA, 2 different DAs, were just allowing relationships to get in the way of actually finding justice for this little girl in her murder. Like, it's ridiculous. Okay, so here is where we're going to start talking about something that is a little disturbing, I would have to say, but it really is going to tie a lot of this behavior together, bring us back full circle to the last episode where we discussed some of the interesting behavior that Burke exhibited and also in his interview with the psychologist. There is something called sexual behavior problems, which is when a child exhibits behavior, especially of a sexual nature, that is abnormal and kind of extreme, especially for that age. So I want to tell you some of the facts about SBP, which is what we will call it. And the average onset age for children to begin to exhibit symptoms of SBP is between the ages of 6 and 9. It may be due to prior abuse, PTSD, anger, fear, emotional detachment. In 1979, the FBI reported that there were 249 rape arrests for kids under the age of 12, and 66 of those were under the age of 10. So these children with SBP can be as aggressive and violent as adults.
Well, and again, as I mentioned before, a lot of people say it's like nature versus nurture. I think a lot of it is nurture, but then again, there are those special cases where it's both. So if you take a child with already like some sort of mental disorder and you nurture it with, you know, maybe favoring another child, maybe this child going through sexual abuse, it's just going to really magnify already those issues that were present.
Yeah, so, you know, because that's a lot of people will say, he was 9 years old. You can't sit here and talk about a 9-year-old like that. Well, you can, because there is plenty of evidence that this stuff goes on. So 30% of adults that are convicted of sex crimes say that they began committing these sex crimes before the age of 9. A study that was done in 1991 said that some of the children that exhibit SBP engage in bedwetting and scatological behavior, meaning poop.
Poop. And we know, yeah. Burke was a pooper.
Yeah. And a 93 survey of SBP therapists, they identified behavior in 222 children ranging from voyeurism to coercion. The more severe cases exhibited digital penetration, penile intercourse, bestiality, ritualistic or sadistic sex abuse, and tying up of victims. They showed a lack of compassion and empathy, and they exhibit inadequate social skills. The victim may be object of revenge or anger and could be viewed as a favorite child. Their families usually portray themselves as being quote-unquote perfect. And there's also a higher incidence of other disorders like separation anxiety or attachment disorders.
This is a good place to bring up that Patsy had battled with cancer and had survived for a while. But, you know, as a child, cancer is a very scary thing. You know that people die from it. So there's a lot of what if mom's not here tomorrow type feelings that possibly could have been going on, which would create a lot of abandonment issues.
Yeah, especially when, you know, he saw his father as being this like distant, busy figure that was hardly ever around.
Yeah, so I mean, it could have been, you know, just a lot of loneliness and neglect, you know, not purposeful neglect, but the feeling of being neglected.
Well, and, you know, so JonBenet was this like beautiful, glamorous little pageant queen who was clearly doted on by her parents. And I can see how that would kind of lead to Burke feeling like she was a favorite child and beginning to have some feelings of inadequacy. And we can also kind of remember that he had some jealousy issues with her that were exhibited already, like with him hitting her in the face with a golf club right around her birthday. I'm sure she had some sort of gift situation that kind of, you know, pissed him off. There's also theory that part of the murder was instigated because of Christmas gifts, and that there were Christmas gifts in the basement that had been torn open, and they were supposed to have more gifts given to them in Michigan. And maybe, you know, it's possible that he had seen something that kind of got him feeling that feeling where he gets jealous of her and it made him angry. And we also, you know, we already talked about how JonBenet had been sexually molested in the weeks or months prior to her death. So, you know, there's a lot of these sexual behavior problem behaviors sure seem to kind of line up with behavior that Burke was exhibiting prior to JonBenet's death.
So I think there was a lot more going on behind the scenes, and it would have really taken a toll on Patsy, and, you know, she would never be able to live down the loss of face.
Yeah, you know, when we see that there's ritualistic or sadistic sex abuse and tying up of victims, like, I hear people say that so often, you know, a nine-year-old doesn't have the wherewithal to make a garrote and choke somebody and blah, blah, blah. And I'm here to tell you, obviously that's not true, because there are actual cases, previous cases, where psychologists are identifying patients that they have who are below the age of 10, who have tied up victims, commit sadistic sex acts, behavior with like pooping in weird areas. They lack compassion and empathy. I mean, it's just, it paints a picture that something was going on with this family.
I wanted to bring up the whole tying up of a victim is a lot of times to perpetuate control, because some sort of control has been taken away from them. They have been belittled in some way. They have been abused themselves, and they couldn't stop it. They feel inadequate and inefficient, so that's their way of taking back that control and picking on a smaller, more helpless victim. It's classic case of why bullies bully. Right. You know, especially children. They come from an abusive home, they pick on smaller, weaker children because it's a way for them to exhibit control and have control over something, because at home they have none.
So yeah, I mean, I believe we've kind of painted a picture with the facts here. Like, this is all just straight up fact, and it is what it is. So Patsy Ramsey actually ended up dying in 2006 from cancer. Burke and John are still kicking it. They're, you know, like we said, Burke gave an interview last year with Dr. Phil. It was a softball interview. Dr. Phil has the same lawyer team as the Ramseys do, and I believe that's probably why that ended up happening. But it's still a troubling interview to watch. He doesn't remember things that I would think he would remember that day very vividly. And he just now he's changed the story to saying he's like laying awake in bed. And
well, he's, you know, he was asleep. His parents are very adamant about him. He was asleep. But, you know, he says, oh, I was listening to my mom downstairs going psychotic.
Yeah. So now he's saying he's just laying in his bed awake, but didn't feel the need to get up.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure it's difficult for you to carry on a elaborate tale for this long, but we're just going to end it here saying that the Ramseys' preoccupation with image laid the groundwork for JonBenet to be murdered, and it gave them motive to cover up the murder after it took place. It's a sad, terrible case, because we're ending it without any closure whatsoever. No one has ever been prosecuted in this crime. It is just, like I said in the opening, the investigators on the case just feel like justice may never be served, because the person that probably committed this crime was underage, and the parents, one of them is not even alive anymore. And I believe the statute of limitations for cover-up of the murder, it has passed. So unfortunately, the only justice that JonBenet will ever get is if somehow we're able to see documents that we've never been able to see before and at least find out who actually murdered her. As it stands, I believe we know.
We're not telling you what to believe or who to accuse, but we are just hoping that this kind of, like we stated in the very beginning, brings light to more evidence that would help you kind of further see into the case and kind of get away from what just the media has portrayed this case as.
Exactly. Like, the actual facts in this case have a bias. It just is what it is.
Yep.
So that's it, everybody. We're done with JonBenet.
JonBenet.
That was another information-heavy episode for you. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about this episode.
Don't forget to tell your friends and family about the podcast. Share our page if you really like it. We appreciate any support and exposure. I hope you're keeping it creepy out there.
Yes. Spread the word, everybody. We will be back next week with a brand new case. We are excited to see you then.
Bye.